So we stay and you go. Yeah, it's interesting being in a monastery. This is kind of not that extraordinary. We treat it as extraordinary, but for us, we have this incredible opportunity to live simply and not have to pay a mortgage. So we're very grateful for your support that we can live this life and try to honor your dana, your generosity, by being diligent and living by our Vinaya precepts and trying to realize peace. So I think all of us are grateful for that. Recently, I've been thinking I've always thought that, but like without Buddhism and the Sangha and being a bhikkhu, my life I would have done something, but it's such a rich life. So I can't believe my good fortune. So as you go into the world, you obviously we want to use the worldly conditions as a way of growing in Dhamma and understanding ourselves, because then it has meaning. So we don't want to, I think we don't want to limit mindfulness practice to just some kind of extreme, like a meditation retreat, because a meditation retreat is an extreme kind of experience for most of us. But to take the lessons of the retreat and try to apply them in ordinary life, I mean, that's pretty obvious. So the mindfulness is not a state of refinement. Samadhi can be a state of refinement. So you can get very delicate and silent and ethereal states of concentration. But then the sense experience that we have normally is just not so refined. The kind of refinement of a shrine room and people who are living morally and who are very supportive and sensitive to each other. Sometimes it's not going to be like that. Sometimes people will be coarse or difficult or certainly not interested in Dhamma. That will be common. So the silence of knowing isn't the silence of, it's not an external silence. External silence is dependent on conditions. So the external conditions are very gentle and very beautiful on this retreat. I can't imagine a better time to do a retreat. The colors, I think we all found them, it's totally stunning. And so that's our good fortune. But then as that changes to something more coarse, like the traffic in Toronto or complexity, speed, all those kinds of things come up. Is our refuge truly in awareness, or are we still very much attached to conditions? And that's the challenge. So when we're still attached to conditions, then of course we feel upset, anxious, frightened, worried, da-da-da-da-da. And then that's the test. That's the test of mindfulness. And the test of mindfulness isn't so much that you won't feel those things, but can you find the center of silence within the complexity and the more coarse parts of life? That's the interesting challenge, because that's the transcendent challenge. That's the challenge that is possible to practice and realize throughout daily life. So no matter what happens, I hope you just float through the rest of your life and have a kind of you'll bring her death. I don't know if any of you saw The King and I, which was not that there was apparently a more recent version, but the old must have been from the 50s. And Yul Brynner is King Mongkut, and he's dying, and there is no mucus on him. He's well shaved. You know, he looks ethereal, and then he just poof. So, and I really wish you total silence, peace, and bliss until your Yul Brynner moment. But I suspect it's going to be more challenging than that. So then more realistically, I would wish you good practice. I mean, I wish you good health, obviously, and good friendship, and prosperity, and all those things. But probably more profoundly, I would wish you that capacity to take everything on and take it as a challenge. And see, can you find the center of stillness within the confusion or the sickness, say, or the discord if it's negative, or even if it's beautiful? Because there is a still center, and that's always here, and that's the gateway is mindfulness. And that's that image of which I mentioned earlier, the image of the wheel and the axle of the wheel. This is quite an interesting one to take on when you have something like sickness or some kind of more coarse stuff going on. So the sound is quite coarse, or the bodily feeling is coarse, painful. And then you, as you listen and receive that sense experience, in the very listening, you begin to see, if you don't go out to that sense experience, if your attention doesn't just go out there and stays home in the center, you touch this kind of silence. And you begin to see that there's that, the wheel is spinning around, but the center of the wheel is not moving. And that's one of the ways we classically were. And kind of an analogy to what we mean by letting go, non-grasping. Some of you might have seen the video, The Buddha Comes to Sussex. It's probably on YouTube, I don't know. If you have a chance, or it'll be on an Ajahn Chah site. There's actually an Ajahn Chah website, just on Ajahn Chah materials. And there's a lovely video there, Buddha Comes to Sussex, when we went to Chithurst in 1979, and Lompocha was visiting then, and the interviewer is asking Lompocha, so what's the essence of Buddhism? And Lompo says, play wang, just, he's lovely, he's sitting on his bench, and you know, he has a very wide, beautiful mouth, a beautiful smile, and he's just saying, wang, and play wang means let go. Ploy is like if you let go, if you let a fish loose, you get a captured fish. And wang is like empty space. Ploy wang, that's the, I probably have the tones wrong, but that's what the Thais use. And so the interviewer asks Lompo Cha, what do you mean by letting go? He says, ploy wang. It's let go. And that's the doubting mind. The doubting mind tries to figure that one out, and we talk about it, but, and you know, we need to use language, but what is non-grasping, letting go? This is the language Theravada uses, still centered in the hub is spinning around. So what I've suggested on this retreat is like just kind of playing around with different ways of considering what mindfulness might be, because words become quickly dead, don't they? You know, we just, as Buddhists, we say, be mindful, oh yeah, be mindful. But somehow to enliven the mind, right, to make it bright and present and fresh and new, to the same old story, to the same old kind of teaching, is a challenge. Because we can become kind of habitual and so on. So I was using language like receptive, listening, available, watchful, just language. But you see that all that kind of language is not pointing to getting any particular experience. So it's not based on grasping. It's not based on becoming. It's not based on tanha, on craving. It's based on letting go. This is the way it is now. And it's extraordinarily difficult just to awaken to this moment just as it is. It's surprisingly elusive. Surprisingly elusive. Beauty sometimes really strikes us. We're arrested by beauty. In the seeing of a tree, our mind, like a golden maple, we become silent. But remember, it's not the tree, it's your mind. See, the beauty arrested the mind into silence. So then you can use beauty that way. You just let your mind rest in that non-conceptual, judging, discriminating stuff that we'd always do. You know, like when you look at the tree, before you conceptualize it as a beautiful maple, just let the tree come to you. So that's that sense of receptivity. From that basis of awakened mind, awakened consciousness, we're more likely to see what kind of choices we make, what kind of intentions we make. And no matter how difficult any moment is in your life, no matter how confusing or unpeaceful the moment is, or the situation is, and I don't wish you that, but it might happen, you can always awaken to it. You can always just say, wow, this is really difficult, or this feels, I feel really confused, or something quite honest like that. And then from that awakened consciousness, one can continue to make the right decisions towards peace. The mind might not be peaceful, the situation may be difficult and chaotic, but we can always make choices towards peace. So the training is one of whatever happens, just keep making the right karma, keep making the right intentions, just make the right choices. So what are the causes for peace in the future are what we do now, what we think now, how we speak now, and how we act now. And that we can always do that. We may not have much compassion in our hearts. At times we may be just totally fed up, or at times we may feel quite a lot of self-doubt. And then as those moods come up, the important thing is to not create a person where there's no person. Whatever the mood is, self-doubt or arrogance, confidence or anxiety or hopefulness, or these are changing atmospheres of consciousness that we experience. And when we create a person, when a person's created from that material, then what comes from that is a narrative. And that narrative puts us in time, puts us in a sense of self moving through time, and that is not the timeless, that is not the deathless, that's not nibbana, that's not freedom. So letting go then is the non-belief in the personhood. It's just not believing that sense of a person that keeps arising. Socially, as I said earlier, we still have, like last night I said, we still have our social definitions, our responsibilities. That's where personhood is kind of used in Buddhism, in the conventional reality of me and my the way I'm situated in the world, who I am. So my responsibilities as a senior monk or as a monk in itself, and so on and so forth. Sila that I live by. So that's the kind of vehicle I travel in. So that's what I observe. So there's a sense of Viradhammo being a person, but then as the phenomena of mind arise and cease, don't take it personally. There's a kind of paradox there. So as the moods come of liking or disliking or whatever it is, don't create a person where there's no person. The mood is there, but the person is something that's an addition. And that very person, the creation of a person, is what we mean, another way we talk about attachment and grasping. So look, look very carefully at your own consciousness and your own habits. What kind of person gets most strongly defined in your thoughts? And where does the sense of me and other come up, and how is it most strong? And begin to see that as an object. Be aware of that. So there's, as the sense of a person arises through moods, if we're just aware of that, we say, oh, that's just a mood, or that's just a memory, and we hold to that mindfulness, then the narratives don't kidnap us, and we're not preoccupied with the narratives of suffering and alienation. But if we believe in that personhood, then it seems very real, and we can make it very real. So the teachings on anatta, on not me, not mine, are not philosophical positions, but they're kind of constant tools that we try to employ to get to the sense of objective awareness. Not me, not mine. So the mood comes up, self-doubt, say, and that sense of a person starts to kind of gain a foothold, and then mindfulness and the reflection, recollection of Dhamma, recollection of anicca, dukkha, anatta, not me, not mine. Unsure. Now that is an exercise in perception rather than a final philosophical position. If we take Buddhism as a kind of final, Buddha said there was no self, that doesn't really work, because that's just an opinion or an idea, and it's not even correct according to the texts. But taking anicca, dukkha, anatta as a kind of working perception that cuts away that whole creation of a person, keeps undermining it, not me, not mine, is an exercise you have to do quite mindfully. You have to remember to do, you have to recollect, you have to remember. Not sure. And so Lompo Cha, always not sure. And try it. Try it for like 5 years. See what happens. So it's not just a kind of one-off that you do, it's a kind of way of developing thought, our perceptual processes, which are in line with the Dhamma, which are aligned with the Dhamma. And if we align with the Dhamma, then that really leads us to enlightenment, to freedom. But it has to be done systematically. It has to be sustained in a kind of quite a rigorous manner, I suppose. Not me, not mine. So the moods where the sense of self is most powerful is where you get the most freedom, actually, because that's what preoccupies the mind. If my mind is preoccupied with anticipation 50% of the time, if I begin to work with that and become quite adept at anticipation or not believing in it, and still live responsibly, still plan responsibly, but that whole sense of a self becoming something in the future, I just really, really work with that, then if that's 50% of my problem, then by addressing it, there's 50% of your freedom, as it were. So the thing that most preoccupies your consciousness is very important to look at, not as a judgment, but just as recognition. What kind of a sense of self comes up most often? And then you get really good at your own committee that's up there, kind of judging you or doing whatever it does in your mind. And you just get really, really good at that. Really, and each of us has a different kind of group of characters that inhabit consciousness. And we just get to know these characters and not believe in them. To make it really workable, I think the heart qualities are more than invaluable. I'd say I don't think you could do without them, really, because we are heart beings. And so the difference between sentimentality and true goodwill, sentimentality is, when you see the chipmunk, oh, is he cute? That's sentimentality. which is fine, because that's just the way we're constructed. If the chipmunk chewed on your electrical cable or nested in your cooking pot, you know, your sentimentality would morph into something else. But goodwill is not sentimentality, is it? Goodwill is a profound way of relating to all things. And so that encouragement of goodwill is one of the touchstones of good meditation, good Dhamma practice. You doing all right there, Don? Yeah. Get it out. So like, it seems in Western culture we tend to be goodwill towards ourselves seems to be one of the more difficult things to remember. So look, you know, if that is the case, look at how the mood of self-disparagement comes up, and how the belief in a self-doubting kind of belief, or a self-disparaging, self-critical, that kind of thing comes up, and just see it, not me, not mine, and play with it. Like if you get a critical mind comes at you, say, yeah, but I still love you. Whatever you need to do, whatever, humor, to make it ridiculous. Yes, I'm a killer, I'm hopeless. I remember once I was very, very concerned about some minor rule in the Vinaya, and I went to one of the monks who was senior to me and said, oh, I've just done this thing, which was so minor. He says, you haven't killed anyone. And it was so helpful. Yeah, that's true. I just kind of, and this is just like perfectionist mind, or idealizing how we should be and all the rest of it. Sense of self manifests in all these different ways. And the key is noticing how that sense of I becomes a kind of predominant perception. I. And then noticing, not me, not I. No, you know, it's not true. It's just a mood that's come up according to causes and conditions. So the Buddhist path isn't one of kind of constant self. It's not like you're just thinking about yourself. It's not that. It's you're noticing the inner world and actually letting go of that sense of being this limited kind of a person to something more grand, which is awareness and compassion and so on. So it's a path that requires, consistency, doesn't it? You just have to really just stick with it and do it. The sitting practice is very helpful because that always gives you a kind of window into what's been going on in your day, or what you anticipate the day will be like. It's a window into what the moods of the mind are like, or what you've accumulated through the day. So it kind of helps you to see what's evolving. And then also, if you develop a good, strong, consistent practice, you get the skills of calming the mind, and the mind is calmed much, much more quickly. You also get the skills of having more sustained mindfulness throughout the day. And then if things do get triggered, which are difficult, that mindfulness helps you to process them. So the sitting practice develops a lot of paramita, develops a lot of patience, a lot of sustained mindfulness, a lot of a sense of inquiry, and different kinds of things. And of course develops a sense of calm, where the mind can become calm and settled. So that's always been encouraged to do daily, just like having a shower or whatever. Just do it as much as you can. So I don't know when we'll do another retreat like this, but it's been a wonderful experiment. So I think maybe, shall we finish with some chanting?
Chanting, yeah.